Can you say that again to suffer in the sultry interior?
Right. Suffering.
Suffering for art.
Oh, I suffer.
The sultry interior.
My God.
Good line. There he was, suffering for art. In this, open it up. That's how I'll open this.
I will say that I just can't stand the pain.
Suffering for art.
I cannot. I will not be countenance to pain inflicted upon me by some cultural phenomenon.
Well,
have you turned on?
Yeah, I did. This is my new favorite thing to do. This is my new favorite thing. It's just suddenly turn it on before anyone knows that they're being recorded.
Brassai, the great photographer, did the same thing. He would just cover the camera and like, boom. This is great. So what's the subject tonight?
Brassai. Did you say Brassai?
Brassai.
Ah, Brassai.
B-R-A-S-S-A-I. The French photographer.
Okay.
Yes, but the French were great at the proper formation of the female lung. Whatever.
The female lung. Just not. That's compared to the male lung.
Just not fighting, not having generals.
Not having general.
Yeah, I think that's interesting about the French is they're still the most rigid, Louis XIV's structure in history where they get all these...
You mean military structure?
Yeah, they get all these dickhead generals that can't
well, they find out. Dickhead. What
can't find their ass from a hole in the ground and have lost like three wars in a row.
That would explain the trench war then.
Exactly.
Slip trenches.
Exactly.
And if you're looking for some place to, I don't know, relieve yourself with your dick, there's nothing more proper.
All right. And here we go. Another episode of Western Thought with, we are featuring, Tom Straw, painter and writer, and a man who has eliminated many of his resistances, in my opinion, is very open, and was also a narrator for my audiobook.
Well, thank you. I would. I have to say I'm glad to be here. This is my first time so far. So far as I can remember.
Which is always good when you get screwed. It's always good when it's in your own home.
But I can't remember any farther back than that.
Farther back than what?
The first time.
The first time of what?
Being here.
Oh, being here. Oh, yes. Right.
And it's a pleasure.
I'm glad.
I would like to... I would like to hear what your normal opening is. I would like to hear...
We have not had a normal opening.
Well, I would like to hear...
Okay, I'm going to do the opening. The opening is this.
We're
going to talk about Vladimir Nabokov and his novel, 1961, Pale Fire, which is ostensibly a poem by an American poet named John Shade, the so-called editor Charles Kinboat creates an hilarious...
Kinport.
No, Kinbote.
It's Kinport.
It's
he
a
said
bee.
So at
There's
the
a bee.
Even before we met, he said so.
Kinport?
Only because you look at Mount Kinport every night, Tom. But is Kinboat, K-I-N-B-O-T-E, who is ostensibly the editor... And glorious. So anyway, what we're going to do is, Jonah, if you would open up, well, I'm just going to do it, because you two guys are like totally out of control. I can't deal with this. The poem is
The poem
Pale Fire.
Yes. Why is it called Pale Fire?
From Shakespeare.
So he says, but he can't find the reference in Shakespeare.
That's true. That's what he says.
Canto 1. And I think Tom makes a very great point. The whole essence of this novel is falsity, false bottoms, Everything. You cannot trust anything.
Exactly.
If you start picking up the dictionary, as I did, on like page 5,
yes.
You finally go, screw this, man. Right?
No, that, you want to know what some of the words there. Come out of this? Nictification.
Well, that's
a... Hoyden, Ankyalula, Lemiscate, and Orbicate of Jasp.
But those are real words.
Orbicate? Yes, they're all real words.
Those are, Orbicate makes up
of
a lot.
Jasp?
Yes.
But he makes up a lot of other ones.
Orbicule of Jasp, I'm sorry.
Orbiculate of Jasp. Jasp, yeah. And which is a truncation of Jasper. Okay.
Here yes.
We go. Okay, can we just get started here? Because I'm not going to be here all night. Canto 1. Canto 1.
Pretty weak.
Canto 1. I was the shadow of the waxwing slain by mm-hmm. the false azure in the window pane. I was the smudge of ashen fluff, and I lived on, flew on, in the reflected sky. And from the inside, too, I duplicate myself, my lamp, an apple on a plate. Uncurtaining the night, I let dark glass hang all the furniture above the grass. And how delightful when a fall of snow covered my glimpse of lawn and reached up so as to make chair and bed exactly stand upon that snow out in that crystal land. So that's the poem by the English author. Then you have this strange editor annotating this, so to speak,
right.
which becomes the prose part of the second part.
Okay, so to be more succinct, in Pale Fire, there is a prose poem that a kind of deranged lunatic.
How can you call this a prose poem? It's rhymed.
Oh, it's oh, sorry.
It's a regular rhyme, and it's not consistent throughout.
Right. Come on, if you're going to be succinct, let's be.
I agree. It is not
a little too succinct.
Not enough succinct is what you're saying. It wasn't.
It's a beautiful poem, actually.
Beautiful poem. That's what I was trying.
It is an extraordinary poem. I didn't know that until. Jonah had pointed it out to me.
Yeah.
I haven't read this thing in 50 years until now, and for a reread. But the poem is exquisite. The first two lines tell you just about what's going to happen here. I was the shadow, and the shadow keeps showing up throughout this whole compilation of the waxwing slain. The waxwing is a bird, he's a bird watcher. And the waxwing is slain because by the false azure in the window pane, the bird flew in the frigging window pane. Bang!
Right in your place.
I was a smudge of ash and fluff, and I flew on in the reflected sky. The thing is, he thought, coming right to the window, that he was going to go into the continuing dimension, but there was an invisible dimension that he just smacked into.
Right, and the poet's name is John Shade, mm-hmm. and the poet and the poet's name is John Shade. Gray's Gradus, the mm-hmm. assassin is Gradus Gray. Mm-hmm. He plays on Gray throughout that.
Right.
Also in the description of Rock Mountains in the Alpines of Europe. He is always just juxtaposing shadow and gray face.
Absolutely.
So that is replayed throughout it.
Right. So shadow is a big thing. Mm-hmm. And the illusion of some existence beyond an invisible pane is also part of it. Because there are windows are so huge throughout this whole discussion.
Absolutely so, yeah.
He spends time, jump in anytime you want to.
No, go on.
Windows are a way of looking into a parallel universe, and so he's got multiple universes going on.
And he repeats that throughout the narrative.
He does.
Kinboat. Now we have to, for the listener, mm-hmm. we have to distinguish between the poet, fictitious John Shade,
mm-hmm.
and the commentator, the editor, Kinboat, who, as you say, is constantly referring to this window, to these other dimensions.
Yes, and he's looking into windows as a parallel universe, and then he, for example, he uses window as a pass-through. And he even does that later with Gratis, the assassin. We pass through Gratis. He does this incredible discussion or description of entering into Gratis's body and going down through his very parts, and then we get, especially at the end there, where he has his...
He has diarrhea.
Yeah, yeah, so you've never seen diarrhea examined by anybody until you get to this guy.
Well, I have to stop you here. I mean, you shouldn't... Scatological is fine, but the point you make is exact. How people become windows for us into another reality.
Exactly.
And precisely. That is a brilliant point.
Yeah.
I can talk about two ex-wives.
They have windows? Or they have windows into you? Which is it?
The metaphor is just multiplied, Tom.
Okay.
Metaphor.
I'm going to shut up for a while. I would like to ask Will to describe where we are, because I remember listening to the first podcast. He did a very expressive description of being X number of meters from the railroad tracks.
Right.
Well, and we're still in the same town.
You're in the spot.
I'll give it to you because we...
No.
We are here above the beautiful tree-lined floodplain of Pocatello with the Nabokovian angular hillsides shadowed right to left by the sun on almost the midsummer. It's just the most beautiful night ever.
Oh, that's true.
So
yeah, it is beautiful.
And so it's tremendous. And but anyway, back to Pale Fire.
No, but back to
Nabokovian description.
A Nabokovian shadow.
Well, they are, because if you notice, having lived in, he's writing this in Montreux.
This is Pope. It's light and dark.
You know? Yeah, okay.
You're right. A lot of his descriptions, as a writer myself, Tom, I can tell you a couple of his descriptions of, rock faces, where he describes kind of like the jointing of and bedding of two different, vertical bedding and joining of huge pieces of rock, and then he puts in the shadowing of the shadow and then the gray, kind of joining. Oh, yeah. I've never seen anybody describe rock like that. I mean, Nabokov.
We were talking earlier about.
And the other thing I want to finish about is, and Shade is writing on index cards.
Yes.
Nabokov was an index card writer. He was.
Yes.
He was a en plein air. He was an en plein air painter. He would go out.
Oh, yeah.
Into the real world with note cards, and when he saw something and his mind and his word, like Jonah was saying, we organize reality through language. He is organizing descriptions of what he's seeing.
Absolutely.
On note cards. So throughout Pale Fire, you see these fantastic descriptions of the natural world.
Absolutely.
In just like two or three lines.
That is the key.
Yeah.
And the thing is, he has such a vision of it. And I didn't know that it was done through note cards, because when I started reading this, I thought, well, here is the... Index cards, yes. But they're very specifically identified with the pink line near the top.
Exactly.
And
so.
And the subsequent linings. We grew up with that, more or less. You and I certainly did.
Right.
And it's kind of a library form.
Right.
It is what who is a person who is highly attuned to the finest detail.
Vladimir Nabokov.
And he's suggesting that he's so in tune to some of the detail he doesn't know the message. That's the first impression I got going into it. So before I knew what was going on before when I thought we're dealing with a madman here.
Right.
And this is where I would invite Jonah to step in. On what do we see on our first voyage into this
world? Well, the first voyage is the foreword.
Yes.
I'll just set Jonah up on this.
Okay.
The foreword is an example of the most brilliant, unreliable narrator on earth, who is just like a criminal madman telling you how he sees the world, and you're going, this guy is crazy. And it is so hilarious. And he's gay to the max.
Isn't he?
He is gay to the max.
Pederasty.
And you are just laughing. I mean, I'm not going to say anything for the rest of the night.
No,
that foreword is so hilarious.
I am
laughing. Tears are streaming down my face. And then you enter what's really a very dark and emotional and painful novel. But that first foreword is so wonderful, I can't believe it.
Well, it's this beautiful comic foreword. And then you actually get to the poem. And, you know, I wouldn't recommend to anyone who's under the age of 25 to read Pale Fire. Because, you know, it's probably not going to make sense to them. But there's that moment where you read the poem after you read the foreword, and you're kind of expecting the poem to be bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
And then you read the poem, and it's actually kind of great. It's really beautiful. And then you go back to the commentary. And the commentary is again engaging with this guy's delusions. But you know, Nabokov is doing a thing where he has designed this character as engaging with the delusions, so you have to acknowledge that he knows what the hell he's doing. But still, even still, after the poem, because it's so beautiful, you're still kind of like, oh my god, this fucking asshole!
And what, like, exactly so. So now we're going from parody, all these so-called genres, and then you've got this farcical, academic, in quotes, a study which reveals the madness of this guy.
Yeah.
But in the narrative of that, Tom, as you know, the real pain of Nabokov comes out because he brings in these scenes of what it's like when the apparatchik, these just low-life sleazebags, come in and take over. So, I mean, it's like you go from farce to deep human tragedy and beyond tragedy. There is no book like Pale Fire. There is nothing like it, man.
Well,
I couldn't believe it. You're just on a roller coaster, man, going through it.
It's worth pointing out what Nabokov is a citizen of St. Petersburg. Grew up in the pre-Soviet world as a very well-to-do young man. And then he had to see the Soviet system come on. And in a way, Zembla, the country of the origin.
The fake country.
The fake country of our narrative. Is it a fake country? This is what has me a little confused.
And, yeah.
But
it's from Pope.
I just want to lay a little groundwork here for the viewer. And if they could get, if we could get the cameraman to get a close-up on Jonah's profile, they would see that he has some resemblance to Nabokov, but not quite the same beak, nor as deep a concave eye passage, nor...
And he's got it all his own teeth.
And he's got, well...
Well, not for long.
But he doesn't
not
have...
Not for long, let me tell you.
He doesn't have that slope-eyed, that quiet-eyed depth of...
I will once I go sober. Then I will.
Then he has it in him because...
then it will fully manifest.
Well, let me go back to the real factor is that when he's in Zembla, it's kind of a Baltic Republic.
Yes.
Between Scandinavia and between the Russian.
Yes.
And what's interesting is that he creates a composite in which the way that the Russian Soviet state is has now infiltrated his country.
So okay, yeah, I think this is my moment. Okay.
Great.
Yeah.
So
it's a one way. There's the only flight is to Copenhagen.
So Zembla, which is based off of our sort of quote unquote editor protagonist's idea is based purely, and you don't even understand this until about page 300 of Pale Fire of Zembla, is he takes it out of Pope. He takes a fictitious word that he saw out of Pope. Pope was inventing a country, and Nabokov takes it and sort of runs with it and invents his own language and ideas behind it. And the whole, you could argue that the whole novel is inspired by Pope, because what he was writing in the poetry was totally Popian. he just wanted to write a poetic piece of verse that was very inspired by Pope. And
do you think the entire novel began from that point?
I think it did. I'm almost entirely convinced that it did. That he wrote the poem first, and then he constructed the narrative afterwards. And
may I suggest that he constructed a parody of his own work?
Yeah.
But parodies, he said, is the last resort of wit.
Right. Yeah, that's good.
But because it twists the view, and our compatriot has gone to sleep.
It's all parody.
Right, but there is no parody.
No,
there is
it's
no
all
parody in Pale Fire, Tom.
It's really? All parody.
It's not.
You talked to me about this before. You said it's all parody.
No,
it's not.
I want to hear about this.
It is not.
Please tell me.
That's why it's so brilliant. It's never the last resort of parody. It's brilliant at all moments. You go from the unreliable narrator of high comedy that it's totally hilarious, and then you go to a very serious poem of intense seriousness and pathos, and then you go to this farcical commentary that swerves into desperate historical terror. I mean, really, there's no parody in it at all. But I want to hear. I want to hear this. If I hear this, maybe I'll change my mind.
Well, I mean, this is the second epistle of Pope's Essay on Man. This light and darkness in our chaos joined, what shall divide the God within the mind? Extremes in nature equal ends produce, in man they join to some mysterious use. Though each by turn the other's bounds invade, as in some well-wrought picture, light and shade. Shade? John
light
shade.
And shade, it's all through here.
And oft so mix, the difference is too nice, where ends the virtue or begins the vice. Fools, who from hence into the notion fall, that vice or virtue there is none at all. If white and black blend, soften, and unite a thousand ways, is there no black or white? Ask your own heart, and nothing is so plain. 'Tis to mistake them, costs the time and pain. Vice is a monster of so frightful men, who has to be hated, needs to be seen, yet seen too oft. Familiar with her face, we first endure, then pity, then embrace. Beware the extreme of vice, was ne'er agreed. Ask where the north, at York, 'tis on the Tweed, in Scotland, at the Orcades, and there, at Greenland, Zembla, or the Lord knows where.
Yeah.
Bravo. Alexander Pope. Oh, my
but
God.
But he mentions Zembla. That's the interesting part.
We did nothing.
No, it's completely... That's where Zembla comes from. It's from
Pope. From Pope.
It's from Pope.
Jonah, if we did nothing, you brought Alexander Pope into the 21st century.
And you brought Beautiful the origin of Zembla into the historical narrative.
Well, no, he puts it in his book. He puts it in the book.
How so?
Maybe page, way ahead.
Okay, at this point, I'm now going to break in. So I read this whole darn thing, and I'm reading whenever he goes into Zemblin, and it's always in italics. And after 200 pages, Jonah, I suddenly realize this is a Russian speaking English. And it took me that long.
Beautiful.
And it's so hilarious. And that's when I suddenly started loving the book. I went, yes, this is the greatest book ever.
For exactly that reason.
Oh, my God.
As the other Russian, as the Pole, who ended up being far more mature with English language than most of the other writers of English nature, and that's Joseph Conrad, who could write circles around the native English speaker. And for that reason, he expresses a greater parody of our language.
Okay, I just could open up anywhere, and it's really easy. Okay, a dream king in the sandy waste of time.
Yes.
Where you have 300 camels and 3 fountains. On Sagran, Worm, Tremkin, Tristana, Verbala would give a tree fontana. I mean, it's Yiddish. Just, it's just Russian Yiddish.
Yes,
English.
Yes.
And I mean, I started reading that and I'm going, oh man, Nabokov, you got me, man.
Because he had no problems with languages that way.
No.
And if you were in California right now and you went into a strip mall, you would hear language just like this.
Oh, yeah.
I'll give you tree fontana.
When I came out of Washington, D.C., Northern Virginia was exactly the same way.
Really? So there were a lot of Russians there?
No, there was the multilingual was
right,
just
right.
Astounding, and that was the gorgeous part of it.
Right.
That was the joy of living there.
Right.
There wasn't a whole lot of other joy living there, but that was... No, right, seriously, right, if you're into culture and language... Right.
That's the great book by... That's a great book by Steven Pinker of how all these pigeon cultures of the Pacific, where you got a lot of Malaysian, Chinese, working in these fields, and they would be speaking pigeon English like this. We'd give indeed like that. And then the children in the first generation would be speaking the most elaborate Popian language with the subjunctives, conditionals, everything.
If you study a foreign language, whether it be French, German, or the other European, I can't speak for the others, you are taught these declensions of meaning across the board that is natural to the native speaker who hasn't a clue what he's doing.
But that's the point in Pinker, is that the child will place it into a semantic logical language, because, as Pinker says, we have a language organ in our brain that we will organize it all and make it just like the waves and the wind. We'll make it all beautiful.
And I believe that, Nabokov in this text refers to word puns as a combinational magic. And in my mind, a lot of this was sort of like a word slapstick, language slapstick, because he could take the English language and just pun it up. And one sequence that I just really admired, he was staying with an upper class family, I don't remember the circumstances, but the upper class family had the Zemblin equivalent of the Encyclopedia Britannica. And it started on A, at the lowest level as it proceeded in a bookcase that ran up several series of stair steps to get to the top. By the time it reaches the top, it hits Z. And then when it hits the attic, the appendix bursts.
Well, Nabokov's a big fan of Shakespeare, and
contrapuntal techniques, top pyro techniques.
He gets pretty vulgar at times.
Yeah. Well, there's great moments with our main character, John Shade and Charles Cabot, where they're having a conversation, right? And John Shade talks about him teaching a class, and he says to Charles Cabot, Charles Cabot is questioning his love of Shakespeare, and he's like, "You just love that purple stuff." And he's like, "Yeah, I love that purple stuff. It's like a mongrel rolling in the piss of a Great Dane."
That's exactly right.
I bought that same passage. No, brilliant.
Yeah,
lines, yeah, brilliant lines. Yeah. Well, I think you brought a great point. Is that to me, Shakespeare. Nabokov is the new Shakespeare, because we as English speakers have grown up with the language and everything, and Nabokov comes from Russia and suddenly sees this glorious, you know, infinitely amorphous, malleable language.
It's one of the magnificent languages of the world.
And he starts playing with it because he sees all the possibilities with a new eye. He's like an immigrant. Exactly. And, you know, in the era of El Trompisto, Nabokov was the greatest immigrant on earth. I mean, we can talk about the Chinese technocrats and everything, but Nabokov was the greatest immigrant in the last 100 years who just reshaped the language.
I agree.
By seeing it totally new.
I agree.
And Joan and I and you could never have done it.
No.
Because he took the dictionary out and he went, God.
That's it. I mean, he comes up with some, I expect Will to know a lot of these words. Nictitation?
Well, of course.
Hoyden?
Of course.
Okay. Amsalula?
Sure.
Okay. Lemniscate?
Of course. I had to
look, no, come on.
I had to look up. Jonah! I had to look up Lemniscate.
Yes, I did too. Well, I looked up all of them, actually.
And what does it mean?
Except for nictitation.
Well, nictitation is the birds. The bird has the nictitating membrane, when they dive through the air, they've got to have a protection against their cornea, or the air will destroy their cornea. That's the nictitating membrane.
I expected you to know these.
Well, I knew all this. Lemniscate, I didn't know. And
it's a mathematical term.
Right. And the mathematical is a geometrical term.
Mm-hmm.
And gosh,
it is.
I read it up, and it's the infinity symbol.
Yeah.
Of course, Nabokov could not say the infinity symbol. He had to say lemniscate. But he loved the word
because
lemniscate.
Because he liked using it.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. Nabokov, like an Elizabethan poet, saw the English language as infinitely something to shape and change, and just glorious.
And that's why what one could argue is the primary language of the world now, because of its flexibility and its acceptance.
Well,
and its willingness to.
Well, it has like a vocabulary of like a billion words. I mean, cassava, cassava, mango, coffee, you go on. Half the language.
That's because
is
it willingly
language.
Adapts. Other words, it willingly takes in other words. Whether French will has an academy that will have to rule on acceptance of a particular.
Right.
The Germans do likewise. I mean, do likewise in adaptation.
Well, just like the great word brouhaha.
Ah,
it's a Spanish phrase.
Oh,
and it's got these elements of witchcraft and brouhaha, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, no English is the greatest language on earth. And you know, it's just you can't get around it. And actually, I have to throw in a tip my hat to the Anglo-Saxons, because Anglo-Saxon poetry was the basis of prosodic poetry and anapoetic, just power.
Say more about that. Say more about that.
Well, I mean, you've got glide, gritty, gleam. You've got all these. You've got all these. You know, guttural, Germanic, but they're not in German. They're only in Anglo-Saxon. And
the
gritty gleam of the railroad yard.
Yeah.
At night. That's all Anglo-Saxon. And then you put on all these beautiful, lemnication, all these Latin words. Now you got something that's like, man, we really can have a lot of fun with this, right?
Wow.
So yeah, no, that was my great realization, Jonah. When Jonah brought up talking about Pale Fire, and I got back to it. So I actually, I just say, I won't say anything more tonight.
No.
I took a 4-hour class in Nabokov.
Oh, really?
In 1975,
ooh,
at the University of Utah. And I read everything.
Well, it was Utah after all.
Everything you read him, and really, I was telling Joni, you can't find any more, but Ada, or
yes,
Ardors in the Arbor with Ada.
I've read that.
You have read that?
Yes, I have.
It's a glorious book.
It's
the Vein, and is it interesting? The twins.
Yes.
The Vein sisters. The Vein sisters. Nabokov is always really interested in twins.
Yes.
And the mystery of twins. The Vein sisters, the brothers in Ada that are kind of courting Ada, right? And but interestingly enough, there's no twindom in Pale Fire. There's no. There's none I can think of.
That's
so, so that shows you, in an artist, he'll have this kind of fancy, and then for a whole novel, he won't even tell
you. Well,
right?
You know, obviously, everything about, you know, Penin, Pale Fire, Ada, and then, you know, what comes after. But those three novels specifically, it's just they have a aura of freedom.
Yeah.
That is just like intoxicating.
Right, right.
I agree.
Like, you know, he wrote Lolita.
Right, exactly.
And Lolita got him out of Lolita got him out of academia.
Right.
Yes, but this has references to
Lolita. And then he gets to make a comic novel about academia.
This is what this
with a blatantly gay. It's the greatest tour de force ever, man.
This
blatantly gay giant. Probably
we haven't
touched
on the aspect that this is an anti-academia tour de force.
Yeah.
But if you get in the anti-academia, it's there. But if you get into that, then you lose all the glory of it, I think.
Well, no, I don't think so. I mean, I think it's kind of what makes it magical. I mean,
really,
the only people who could write such comic novels about academia itself
exactly so.
Would be someone
if they
who
had endured it.
Yeah,
exactly so, man. Exactly.
As I mentioned to you, W.S. Auden wrote excoriatingly about being in graduate school. And this is almost the same.
But Jonah, you really put your finger on it, man. Pale Fire is all about freedom. Just the artistic freedom and the joy of it.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Absolutely, yeah, definitely.
We could talk all night, but that's the best line.
It is, and I agree.
It's so beautiful.
Comes from what?
Like
what does the freedom come from?
I don't know. I guess it's a complete lifelong love of poetry, and it's also a complete lifelong obsession with literature.
Yes.
And as I said before, I think he wrote the poem before he wrote the novel.
Okay.
I think he conceived of this character of John Shade not even while he was writing the poem. Okay, so like as I know about writing things is you take a certain idea and you compartmentalize it, and you're like, okay, this idea is good for this, this idea is good for this, and then we'll combine them and try and figure out how they meld. And I think he was engaging with the index card thing,
mm-hmm.
and he wrote a great poem, and he was like, well, Jesus, what am I going to do with this?
And what would an academic do to it?
Yeah, and what would an exactly. What would an academic, think about this, what would a delusional academic, because all these academics are delusional, they're totally self-obsessed, right? They're like, they just get into it for their own damn reasons. And it's
well,
like,
no, advancement comes from analysis and your appropriation of somebody else's text.
Exactly.
That's power.
Yeah. But you know, also in a weird way, it's like, he turns it into this minor beauty of where he's like, you know, he's this king, and he's like, well, what I'm going to do with my life is spend my time deconstructing literature masterpieces with other brilliant young people.
But did he have to? And if his history is played out, that's what he ended up with, as opposed to just going through a rain. But I agree, the and that's the part I agree with.
You're throwing me with your Nationals t-shirt. Yeah. You look like an old baseball, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You look like a bullpen coach.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sorry about that.
Call in.
And you call
I cannot keep.
But I have to say
call
that
in the reliever.
You called time out at the wrong time.
I did. I'm going,
what the hell?
I'm not able to keep up with you guys. I just want to work out.
I don't think you gave us enough to drink, basically.
Now, here's the thing.
I mean, as a coach, my criticism of a player towards a coach is you just didn't
give enough to drink.
But
there's only two things that I want to.
Hey, look, we haven't even got started. Come on.
Yeah, there's only two things I want to go through.
I just was hoping you would offer me a beer. That was the one thing I was angry for.
What do you want?
Well, you have to be offered.
No.
You got to do what Tom said.
What?
We give you a big Foster's. Got to give him a big Foster's.
That's why I bought the damn stuff.
That's what Jonah told me. I totally forgot.
Yes, I mean, this is kind of a large can of kangaroo piss.
I know. No. I love Foster's.
And I thought, man,
there
if I were a beer drinker, that's exactly what I'd want.
If he bitches another time, we're going to throw him over the balcony.
Who bitches? Nobody's bitching so far.
Here's to you guys.
There's better not be any bitching going on here.
You know, I can even share this because I haven't even drunk it yet. You want some of this?
What the fuck you... Oh, Jesus. There's a couple I want to...
Here's the Foster's. But you know, I have to drink the Australians. And the New Zealanders down there,
damn right,
protecting our flank.
Oh, are you kidding?
God,
and the shit they've gone through.
I know.
Holy mackerel! I have a correspondent down in Tasmania. He's a former high school compatriot, and he moved to Hobart, Tasmania, back in the '70s because he's fed up with America. And he's able to fill me in with that whole shitty series of fires they've been through.
Right.
And then the COVID. And now it's winter is coming on down there.
Right.
And it's just, he and I have corresponded back and forth. 2-3 years ago. Well, actually, when I was still on the Eastern Shore. And we started writing a story, a novelty story. That in some ways reminds me of this because of the questions of the crossing of parallel universes. I'm a big fan of that notion. In fact, we focused on the fact that parallel universes are very close to one another. And what goes on in one universe can be reflected, not necessarily in the other universe, but there's the infrequent, involuntary crossover from one universe to the other. And this is what fascinates me about Nabokov's story, is the windows aspect of it, because he's looking constantly into windows. He has a pair of binoculars, which he's staring at the... He's alert to whether the windows at the shade house are dark or alive. And when they're alive, he peers into them and observes what's going on there. And he uses that to inform himself about what shade is doing and possibly about what shade is thinking. But as we learn, as we go through this whole precy, is that what is happening in one universe and parallels with another universe is informing a third universe, and you cannot, only the author knows. How can I make this more concrete?
Yeah.
So there is this shifting parallels, shifting parallel universities going on in his head, and only the author is in control, but even though he's in control, he still gets swept up into a universe that is influenced by an idea he has over there. That was not his intention.
So why do you assume there's an author that's in control?
Because there is.
Because I've seen his picture.
He is in control. He is. Absolutely is. If I didn't read a book without...
No, he's talking about the author of infinite universes, parallel universes.
Oh, okay.
Because
no, no, I'm not. I'm talking about the author of this piece.
Because the problem, Jonah, when Tom brings up parallel universes,
we're talking about God, man.
No, no,
well,
we're not talking about God.
Well, that
what I'm, no, I'm bringing back a very confident, logical objection to what he's talking about, is that if you bring in parallel universes, there is always another parallel universe
beyond
commentary
that. Absolutely.
And that
it's an
moment,
infinite series.
It's an infant series. So when he talks about an author in control, this is not a literary author, Jonah.
Well,
this is like
we
single mind author of infinite parallel universes.
You know what would be interesting
no,
to me? Would
doesn't have
to talk
be.
About how...
Or you're going to stop somewhere?
How for the 20th century...
You're going to call a stop on your parallel universes?
How for the 20th century
people...
People thought they had control. You know, like...
Yes.
One never has control.
This control of universes.
Exactly.
Is
very...
Look,
that's what I was saying. You don't think it's kind of like...
No. You know what? It is not that. It is not that.
Will is dancing.
Well, it is not that. Yes, it is not a dance. It is a fact that each contact with another element complicates the number of
the
universes.
Infinite, yeah.
I mean, it so becomes and becomes an infinite.
This is like
that's
so
mathematics.
Natural.
No,
well,
that's mathematics.
It's mathematics.
Is, no,
that's fundamental mathematics, Will.
Let's just get back to it.
All right.
I like the inside.
I want to know. Here's what I want to know.
Okay.
Is what? Who knew what? Going in. Who was? I mean, it took. I'm not, this is your Mormon
upbringing.
No, this is. I'm very slow witted. I'm very slow witted.
No, you got to get out of your Mormon upbringing. It doesn't have to be any of this.
Don't listen.
Before we go any farther along those lines, the orbital of jazz. The orbital of jazz. God damn it. This was one of the major things happening The Orbicle of Jasp. Who
is this podcast for
what?
You?
What?
No, sorry. Go ahead.
How much time have you got left on this?
You got lots.
A lot. Yeah.
Orbicle of Jasp is now a cello and piano sonata.
I love it.
Performed or written by Charles Werninen. I listened to it yesterday, and is devoted to Fred Sherry. You can look this up on the internet, and you can listen to the cello and piano Orbicle of Jasp. And
my hat is off to you, Tom.
And it's 8.5 minutes long.
Can we hear it?
Well, we could. We could certainly bang it up on
Go bring it up and. We'll take it over
there. Well, no.
No,
just,
I don't think that's realistic within the
just keep
recording. But for our viewers...
So obviously, somebody else loved Pale Fire as well.
Exactly. So there's a whole Pale Fire cult.
Right.
And there is a website on Zembla that is the source of the Pale Fire cult. There's a higher Nabokov society... Below that is
overarching.
Yes.
Do you mean that we are just like pawns? We're just like a little cell?
We might be a cell.
I think we're a cell. Well, you're not proud to be a cell.
But it's good to be a cell.
Because I agree completely.
I mean, what are you going to do?
Look at the light on Old Town right now, man. It's lit up every...
We should move this home.
Don't distract us. Come on.
Distract us? Tom talks about parallel universes.
Well,
that's distraction.
Yeah. It's all involved with reverse meanings and whatnot. But
which are the only important ones?
Look at the characters that are in there.
Okay.
Alfin the Vague. Thurgus the Turgid. some of the other...
I love it. Thank you, Tom. Thank you.
Some of the other character pursuits.
Thurgus the Turgid. His
Turgid.
His Charles Kinbolt's grandfather, who built a cavernway under the city of capital of Zembla to meet his operatic girlfriend, which Charles the Great uses to escape the Soviet incursion. So I mean, it's all part of a really nice plot,
right?
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't do anything gratuitously.
Could a dwarf in the police force, I'm sorry, pose as a pigtailed child?
No. Well, the point I'm making, this is not parody.
This is beautiful.
It's totally parody.
It's not parody, of course.
Excruciatingly.
Because to parody, dickhead, you have to parody something else. Farce is original. Farce is always original.
Parody
is not.
Okay, farce is
what
original.
What are you talking about? Totally
but
right.
if you're doing a twist on something that exists,
it's parody.
That's parody.
Right.
Absolutely.
But this is not parody in any way.
Well, the setup for this was.
Here's my question.
I have to guarantee.
Is this a literature podcast?
No.
Are we talking about literature?
No, this is a literature masturbation society.
Ah, yes. Yeah.
Forced to believe he may have persecution mania and hallucinations. Actually, what people had told him, it was halitosis. I mean, so it goes on like that. In the poem, Florida is swept by Hurricane Lolita. Yes.
Which is,
So, okay.
It's kind of like his reference.
And you know,
at this moment, gentle reader, I hate to interrupt these, my brilliant compatriots, but at this moment, after the commentary by the delusional Charles Kinboat, who possibly might be the runaway king of Zembla, there is a notes in which all the characters and all the themes involved in the commentary are explained.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that just affords more hilarity. I mean, it is just spectacular.
I suggest we draw into how this thing ends. Mm. Anybody want to give us a guide?
No,
is that spoilers? I mean,
no, you can't tell the ending.
See, this is it. Jonah asked me a week ago, do you remember the end of Pale Fire? And I said, no. I hadn't read it in 50 years. Did you?
No.
And why is that?
Well, because it's 50 years. Well, I can tell you right now, it's a spectacular ending.
It's a good question.
It's probably one of the greatest...
Yeah, but why didn't you remember the twist?
I've had my ex-wife
say
hello to me in the street, and I went, boy, she's kind of nice looking.
No, we're talking about literature.
But no, we're not. We're talking about memory. There's no way I'll remember something like 50 years. I can't even remember an ex-wife that talks to me on the street. Right. I'm thinking, they're kind of nice looking, and they're friendly. I wonder who they are. Somebody else will say, well, actually, that's your ex-wife, Will.
Yeah, well, Jonah's very familiar with
the last page of Pale Fire is one of the most beautiful bits of poetry.
It is. Ever. It is just a beauty.
And on top of that, it does not cover all the possible
denouements.
I hate to use a French word. But there it is. But then
say it again, the French word?
Denouement. And after that is the afterword and is the notes. And now you have like 20 pages of hilarious, full academic notes that are just hilarious and actually give a lot into the plot. You kind of start seeing certain, you know, ways that Nabokov has braided the whole narrative together. So it's just
there are three components, three character components at least. There's Kimbort, who...
Kimbort.
I'm sorry. Kimbort, who studies the Shade poem. There's Shade, who writes the poem. And there is the... narrative that the author Nabokov supplies to us. And that's where I argue the interjection along the way of each of the parallel narratives creates uncertainty or confusion, or in my case, unknowing. So I would like to know how this thing ends.
Literally or metaphorically?
Or literarily.
That's hard to say. You do it again. Literarily.
I think it ends literarily. I think last page. So anyway, my summation of all this is that... My summation of all this
is
that
do it well.
I give Pale Fire out of 5 stars. I give it 5 stars.
No, come on. Better summation than that. Come on, you can do better than that.
I can't because
yeah, you can.
As you know, as we've all brought out.
Come on.
It transcends all genres, styles.
But why and how?
because, as Jonah said, Nabokov understood what is the nature of poetry. It is freedom. Freedom is the only, you know, and it can be ill-used, true. But Nabokov at no time misuses his total joy in the freedom of playing with every different...
If we're going to be honest, though, We can't know for certain when Nabokov wrote the John Shade poem, right? Like he might have written that 7 years ago, and then he just like had it on his index cards, and they were just sitting in a corner somewhere. And he was like,
Who's going to publish this?
And he's like, nobody. Oh, maybe this
nobody's going to publish this.
This
right?
is a good. This is a good novel, actually. If
no, I think that
I mean
was a great thing.
His lead-in to postmodernism is
right.
Is completely remarkable,
and I think Jonah makes a great point. This is the greatest postmodern novel. If postmodernism means just totally shattering all genres and
no,
going,
but it's knowing
out.
It's knowing the genre. It's not absolutely. It's not about shattering genres, it's about knowing it.
I agree
yeah.
on that part.
What genre is it?
Good question.
What is the genre of Alexander Pope?
No, don't answer it. Don't ask a question with a question. That's what my ex-wife would
say. Certainly the art world has gone through the same question. And they have a zillion ways of answering, and they end up in pockets of this over here and that over
yeah,
there.
Yeah, but you're just totally distracting it. The point is that Nabokov and Pale Fire uses all genres, all voices, everything.
I agree.
And
I agree.
It all comes together. There's nothing phony in anything.
There is not.
It is always there.
It is.
And in terms of what Jonah was saying, which is true, what my feeling is, he wrote this beautiful Anglo-Saxon, it is in, may I bring it up? Iambic pentameter. The whole thing is an iambic pentameter. He writes this beautiful poem and he thinks, what academic periodical is going to publish this? Nobody. So he puts it away, and then somehow, through dream or whatever, he thinks...
Well, he publishes Lolita, and Lolita is a big hit. And
right. I think
yeah.
I definitely think he wrote it before Lolita, yeah. But mm-hmm. I'm just saying that that's how it happened, and that's how we saw how, wait, this is a great poem, but nobody's going to publish it because everybody's writing free verse now, right? And we're all reading Allen Ginsberg and et cetera, et cetera.
But what brilliance it was to do that. What brilliance it was, because it does go into multiple understandings, multiple values, multiple worlds of comparison and crossover.
Right.
And this is what makes it an exceptional piece of work.
I'm with you all the way. Joan and I and Tom are agreed. The poem by John Shade is a fantastic poem. And it breaks all genres. It goes, I mean, it's just absolutely wonderful. And I don't think he could get it published. So he said, well, I'll just kind of hang on to it.
Well, let's listen to how good this poetry is. Sidle and slide.
Mm.
Choose a smooth surd and coast. Meet solid bodies in glissade right through, or let a person circulate through you.
Mm.
How to locate in blackness with a gasp. Terra the fair, in orbital of jasp. How to keep sane in spiral types of space. Precaution to be taken in the case of freak reincarnation.
Mm.
What to do on suddenly discovering that you are now a young and vulnerable toad. Plump in the middle of a busy road. Or a bear cub beneath a burning pine. Or a book mite in a revived divine. I mean, it's just the best. It's so good. It's the best. It's so good. Like, even, like...
A jazz.
Alexander Pope.
Somebody paid homage to that by doing a jazz piece. It's like, that's what the greatest piece around.
Alexander Pope would be like, well, yeah, that's legit.
Right, that's legit.
I agree. I have to agree.
I do.
And I just want to remind our viewers that the Orbicle of Jasp is available online. It's a piece 8.5 mile long cello and piano piece dedicated to Fred Sherry, the cellist. And it was constructed by Charles Wuerinen. And if you go online and just ask for the Orbicle of Jasp.
Charles Wuerinen.
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 How do you spell that?
W-O-U-R-N-I-N-E-N.
Wuerinen.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Thank you, Tom. Yeah. Beautiful work, man. We finally brought a documentarian into this.
Yeah.
A researcher. So, your final
just question. A journalist. That's all. Just a journalist.
Just a journalist. Follows the rules.
Generalist.
Journalist. God damn, I ain't no generalist. Yes, generalist yeah. Used to
you
work
just
for...
Heard that, Jonah. Okay, your final words on this. This is the final broadcast of June, anyway.
So the only thing that really concerns me about the discussion is, how does this thing end?
In the last page, which I think is one of the most glorious pieces of writing...
Amen.
...ever written, which... he owes to Jorge Luis Borges.
Oh, let's not go there.
I'm telling you, man, he stole the last line from Borges.
I can talk to you for hours on that subject.
No, he's the greatest writer ever. He gives you three or four different endings, but none of them include what is the role of the gardener that Kinboat has brought in and how... the missionary has arrived at the door, and his gardener is hitting him over the head with a spade, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in the news reports, you know, all this can be, you know, fantasized is how Kinboat could have fantasized it or constructed it. But that's the only thing that bothers me. But that's what I love about it. Nabokov leaves an open end of at least three or four different scenarios in the last page. Jonah, what's your take?
I was thinking of The Final Analysis, which was a play written by Saul Bellow.
Oh. A play written by Saul Bellow.
Really?
Yeah, it's called The Final Analysis.
Right. Final Analysis. And Saul Bellow is one of your touchstones.
Yeah. I don't have a final analysis.
So were you satisfied with the last page?
It's interesting in the fact that it's not important to the plot, you know, specifically. You know,
What is not important to the plot?
That you know. Spoilers. That you know that Charles Kinboat is the ex-king of Zembla.
You know? May I ask you this? When you originally read this, at which point did you recognize?
It wasn't until very far. It wasn't until very far. It was... It wasn't until John Shade, the character that Nabokov creates, who John Shade has a moment where he asks Charles Kinboat, he's like, "How could you possibly know all these specific details about this person?" And then at that moment, you're like, "Oh, I get it." Yeah. You know, it's like he is that person.
Right. Did none of the references as we went along through the readings of the lines of the poems?
I think that's kind of in a minor way what makes it work.
I mean,
it's not an Agatha Christie mystery.
Yeah.
It's just vague.
It is vague.
Yeah. And King, I can intercede here.
King Alfin the Vague.
Yeah, right.
I can intercede here. In terms of narrative, as a writer myself, you know, you always want to kind of put in these little, you know, hints. And and if you really reread them, you're going, hey, just take those out, Will. You know, just let the narrative flow. There's actually a nice narrative flow to all the commentary. And he doesn't overplay it, but no, yeah. I didn't get it until after a while I did. And then you look back and you go, okay, his name's Charles, right? But this is the whole beautiful thing. What you're talking about is that the whole brilliance of the mirror and the metaphor is that
the mirror and the windows.
They always are replaying one against the other, and you don't know what's really going on. Is he the king's son? Is he the king?
Mm.
Is there this plot? It's all irrelevant to the novel. The novel is all this gorgeous language and emotion. And, you know, the other thing, I'm glad we brought this up, is that, or at least revealed it, is that Charles Kinboat, in parts of the commentary, just does this gorgeous writing that mm-hmm. is spectacular
mm-hmm.
in terms of natural scenery,
mm.
the flash of light, the momentary
absolutely.
Beauty.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, all of this, you know. And so, you know, as Joan is saying, I mean, this is all pretty much a medium for virtuoso writing.
It is the pyrotechnics.
And so the last one. No, I sat for a while thinking, okay, what is the problem with any description of what the real plot is? But we got the gardener. And the missionary coming to the door, da-da-da, who's ostensibly the assassin. None of it works. And that's the genius of the book, is that no denouement is possible with that book. You're never going to know what the hell happened.
No denouement? Tom?
No. No more comment.
Okay, so I'll just bring this up. What is the role of the Mexican gardener who is ostensibly on the run from the law
mm-hmm.
that Charles Kinboat hires to take care of his garden and ends up as the assassin, a.k.a. a missionary under the delusional mind, starts shooting at Kinboat,
uh-huh.
and the poet is behind him,
yeah.
or is it just, did Kinboat just finally get the precious text of the poem and turn and shoot?
Or where did Gardner come in this?
That's what I'm telling you. I mean, if you're reading, you know, any detective novel, delusional Kinboat, okay, here's my take on it. Number one, delusional Kinboat finally gets all the precious index cards that the poet is, you know, telling the story, right? And he lures him back and shoots him, and shoots John Shade. That's one. Two, less credible, the assassin, if he really is the king of Zembla,
mm-hmm.
the assassin is at his door knocking, part of his delusion, and turns and sees Kinboat and starts shooting him, and as he says, Charles, Kinboat tries to protect the poet behind him and allows himself to be shot, which is illogical because if he is, he's that big, he's going to get shot, not John Shade the poet, who ends up with a bullet through the heart.
Run.
So all evidence points towards Charles Kinboat, madman, thinks he's the king of whatever.
Yes.
Shoots his Johnson. Buddy through the heart.
Yeah.
And somehow talks his criminal, you know, on the run gardener to take the blame by hitting the missionary over the head with a spade, who's supposedly done this, and saves everybody's lives, right? Mm. So that is what I think is the final plot.
Yeah. Yeah.
My thought is that none of this is final, and these are only impressions of things that happened to individual people represented by the narrative.
And that is a novel. Tapping out.
As we look at the last flames of the setting sun licking the tops of the Pocatello Hills.
Oh, come on. We've got so much more to say.
No. I have to agree. This is, you know, this is overlooking where you guys have been before. You are some meters from the rail yard in downtown Pocatello. If you could go higher up from here, you would see the UP rail yards as an empty acreage, a large acreage in the center of the city. That's nothing but dirt.
And kerosene.
And kerosene. And FEMA, or what? No, I'm not FEMA.
Seven Superfund sites.
Superfund sites.
I have to tell you, Tom, I was walking over the overpass today. And
which
I
overpass?
Down, the Gould Street overpass. And there's this machine, and it was carrying what looked like, you know, 3 foot wide iron ingots, like plates,
yeah.
Right? And I'm going, last week, 3 days ago, I saw it going north, and this time I see it going south. And I realized this ambulatory crane has a magnet. It's holding on to a big disc, and as they pull up the rails to be repaired or replaced,
mm-hmm.
and puts them to the side of the switch track, which is not two lanes, two rails, but four.
Right.
So you can switch it in the middle, switch it to one side or the other. It is going along, and I can see all this loose track that they've pulled up. It's picking up the track with the magnet. 100 years ago, Jonah, it would take 40 men to pick up a, like, 60, you know, 80-foot line. And if they dropped it, it would take off a hand or a... Now you have a guy in a crane along the track picking up track that 80 men would take to pick up before.
That's right.
Picking it up with a magnet, and you can hear the whoom, whoom as the charge goes
That's
through
exactly
it.
Exactly right.
And it picks it up, and then it drops it over to the side, and then it picks up, like, the next 30 feet and drops to the side.
It is amazing.
It was the greatest thing I've ever seen. Yeah. So, thank you, Jonah.
Yeah, and
if you
wanted to live in Pocatello, Idaho, move to North Platte, Nebraska, because that's where Pocatello used to be.
The same damn thing. Yeah.
It is. North Platte, Nebraska is where Union Pacific has modernized everything and left us sucking hind tit.
So,
hucking sign tit.
Well, sucking hind tit or hucking sign tit.
How about hunkering down on the hind tit?
Hunkering down. I would do that.
Well, you know, I was in a bar two nights ago in which three beautiful women
were hunkering down.
About how much they liked to have their da-da-da licked.
This wasn't the Oasis, was it?
Bean?
It was the First National.
Oh, the First National. That's an upscale bar.
All right.
It's still on.
It's still on.
I'm going to turn it off.
Shiona wants to hear more. No,
that's enough. That's more than enough.